This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. We continue to take a look at the 100th anniversary of Negro Leagues Baseball. My guest is Jim Overmeyer, who writes and lectures on baseball history, primarily on black baseball. He's a member of the Negro Leagues Committee of the Society for American Baseball Research, was a member of the National Baseball Hall of Fame Special Committee that elected F.M. Manley and other prominent baseball figures to the Hall. Jim, you're out with two new books. One is the updated version of Queen of the Negro Leagues, F.M. Manley and the Newark Eagles, and Composia, the Homestead Grays, a biography of the Negro Leagues owner and Hall of Famer. Now, with me being from Pittsburgh, the connection you have with the Homestead Grays, and certainly excited to talk about that and chat about F.M. Manley as I wear my Newark Eagles hat for this edition of Sports Jam. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Love the fact that you're from Pittsburgh and you're in Newark. So we've covered it here.
We certainly have. It's a great combination that we'll have for this show. I want to first talk about this updated version that you have about F.M. Manley, and the main changes in the book this time around is that now she's a Hall of Famer, and the fact that you really dip into her life prior to baseball too. Your fascination with F.M. Manley, obviously being a woman owner along with her husband, but where did this start? Where did you want to tell the story of F.M. Manley?
Well, I've been a member of the Society for American Baseball Research, SABRE, since, I don't know, the mid-80s. And in the late 80s, I lived around Albany, and we had a chapter there, which is now defunct. Of course, I'm not there anymore either. So, but we sponsored the National Convention in 1989, and because we didn't have a big league ball game to take people to for a feature, we put them all on buses in Albany and took them to the Hall of Fame, which is only about an hour and a half away from Albany. And we had a preliminary planning meeting in the summer of 1988. And I went, and my wife, Ellen, went with me because, hey, they were giving us free lunch at the Otisaga Inn, the snazziest place in Cooperstown. So why not go? Of course, she didn't want to go to our organizational meeting, so she went through the hall, the museum. And on the way out, we're at the one stoplight in Cooperstown, ready to take a right turn. And she says, "So who was this F.M. Manley anyway?" And I'm a Sabre member. I'm a real expert. And I said, "Who?" And she said, "Well, there's a Negro League exhibit in there. And she was an owner of one of the teams. And she was worked for civil rights and better organization. And you should write something about her." And I said, "Well, okay, a magazine article or something." And it sort of drifted along. And then we had the convention in 89. And I met a mutual friend of ours, Larry Hogan, who had just from at that time teaching at Union County College. And it had just negotiated the donation of the Eagle business files, which had been discovered in the basement of her old house in Newark, to the Newark Public Library. I went there and met with Charles Cummings, the late Charles Cummings, who was then the head of special collections at the library. And he showed me, they had all these papers on drying racks, because the only thing wrong with them, they had gotten damp down in the basement, but they hadn't burned up or been thrown out or anything like that. And I'm looking at all this stuff, and I'm saying, well, I've never written a book before, but I think I can't walk away from these. This is like 12 years of team files, contracts and schedules and all the letters about all the things that go into running a baseball team. So I wrote a book.
Queen of the Negro Leagues.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating book, and even this updated edition is a really inside look at a very special lady who we don't even really know her whole makeup when it comes to being black, white, and you go into that as well. So can you just sum it up quickly for us? What should we know about F.M. Manley? What do we know about her background?
She grew up in an African-American family in Philadelphia and had four siblings or half siblings, depending on how this story ever comes out, if we ever know. And the story that she told late in life, she was, you know, when you get older and you sort of feel free, well, she by then was retired from everything in her previous life and living in Los Angeles. I was getting interviewed a lot as the Negro Leagues were being discovered and rediscovered, and said that, well, when I was a little girl, I got chastised by the principal at my school because I was playing with the white kids all the time. And she was, you know, if you look at the pictures in the book, she was light-skinned, olive complexion, I guess you would call it. That's what she called it. And I came home and I told my mother, and my mother said, you go back and tell her you're as white as anyone, huh? So my mother tells me the story. Well, I am a white person. And while my husband, who is the father of your brothers and sisters, was black, I had an affair with a white businessman that I worked for. And that's the story. Now, she told this story in the 70s. She's in her 70s. And, you know, doing that sort of genealogical research, particularly if something like this has been dropped on you cold and you're not a genealogical researcher, at that time it was pretty hard to do. You had to go and find census documents and birth certificates and maybe on microfilm or pour through places in actual archives where they were kept. Well, needless to say, since all these interviewers wanted to talk to her about baseball, you know, like, okay, that's what you say, and they let it slide. Well, now we're in the internet age, and, you know, it wouldn't be that big a deal, except she brought it up. Maybe a researcher, or somebody says something startling or potentially important, you check it out. So there's a little group of us, including two current generation members of her family, and we've been picking away at this. And what we know now, what we know and what we think we know, is her mother, Bertha, was certainly, most certainly at least half Caucasian. Her mother was a daughter of two German immigrants who grew up in Western Pennsylvania. The story about Bertha's, Effa's father may well be true, because we've identified, she gave a name. I don't want to throw the name out here. I mean, obviously the fellow is dead and buried, the white businessman, but he undoubtedly has a family and we can't prove anything. But Bertha gave Effa a name. Effa used this fellow's name, and there is a very similar name with very similar business credentials, or was at that time, in Philadelphia. Why could he have been the father? Well, Bertha's husband, John Brooks, was 100 years ahead of his time. He was a crook. He dealt in fraudulent mortgage securities, among other things, but he wasn't very good at it, which is to say he never seemed to get away with it. He went to jail twice and prison the last time in Philadelphia. If you put all the pieces of the puzzle together, he was dispatched to prison his second time in 1894 on a 3-year term. And unless he got out good early for good behavior, he would have been incarcerated when Effa would have had to have been conceived, to have been born in March of 1897. So there we are. Will we ever get any farther? I don't know. But is there some credibility to this? Yes, there is. We don't know. We know the name of Bertha's father was a guy named Robert Ford, and he lived in Washington, D.C., and it's too bad he didn't have some, you know, long-winded Middle European name, because we could probably trace him, but Robert Fords are pretty easy to come by, and if you don't have any other information, you're stuck there too. So is there substance to what Bertha told her daughter, and her daughter later passed on? Yes, there is. Is it all correct? We don't know. But it's been a lot of fun. We continue to chase the bits and pieces. Whether we ever come up with anything, I don't know.
It's always fascinating to hear from Jim Overmyer, especially when you read his books. They're so detailed and have so many great pieces. You know, I'm interested, you know, you have a connection to Effa Manley because, you know, she was a great business manager dealing with contracts and uniforms and schedules. You were a budget analyst for the state assembly. So you both dealt with budgets and dealt with figures. So you would know, as you take a look back in her career, if she was indeed good at her job.
She was good at her job. And we don't have a lot, as is always, almost always the case with Negro League data, we don't have a lot of specific profit and loss things, but the Eagle Files do have some tax returns that she and her husband Abe filed, corporate tax returns early in the team's existence, which showed they lost money, which in the mid-30s for the Negro Leagues was pretty likely. There's a fairly complete set of attendance figures at their home park at Rupert Stadium, which used to be down in the Ironbound section there, and the Yankees owned it. Their Newark Bears played there, and the Eagles leased it, and you had to fill out this form because the Bears took a share of the revenue and, you know, as rent. So you had to fill out this form: who attended, what did they pay, what did the home team get, what did the visiting team get, and what did the Bears get for the use of their stadium. So we do have probably better attendance and revenue situation information at home than you can find for just about any team. Of course, they played on the road a lot. Of course, being a Negro League team, they barnstormed a lot. So we're in kind of good shape there. You can sort of get the tenor of reading through these years and years of business letters, how things were going. And the way they were going is they were losing money in the 30s. And in, as World War II started, they started to make money because the Negro Leagues had the kind of counterintuitive situation. While the minor leagues were folding and the white majors were running deficits or not making much money, the black teams were doing really well during the war because there was, as there had been in World War I, there was an influx of blacks moving up from the South to take defense industry jobs and defense support jobs. So here they were. And of course, there was gasoline and tire rationing. So here you are in a new place in the North, and you can't really go anywhere, but you can go to the ball game. So the Negro Leagues did really well during the war. Ironically, of course, as soon as the war was over, integration happened and they died. But it's a strange arc, but that's their history.
Hooray, hooray, the time has really come. Hooray, hooray, the time has really come. Cleveland got Larry Doby, Brooklyn's got Jackie Robinson. Now the pitcher got scared, let Jackie walk. He stole second and third and come home on a walk. Hooray, hooray, time has really come. Cleveland got Larry Doby, Brooklyn's got Jackie Robinson. Doby in the outfield, letting nothing get by. Jackie hitting so safe, you swear the ball had eyes. Hooray, hooray, time has really come.
One of the greatest players of the Newark Eagles was a listener of WBGO. And how do I know that? Because the person I work with each and every weekday morning, Gary Walker, was talking about the Cleveland Indians one day, and he made a comment and he got a phone call. And the other person on the line said, you know, I need to correct you about something about the Indians. He goes, who's this? He goes, it's Larry Doby. And so Larry was certainly a listener of WBGO, and I've met his son as well. And when it comes to Larry Doby, there is a big connection between Abe and F.A. Manley and how they dealt with the Cleveland Indians for compensation when he went to the major leagues. And this was something that you know extremely well. Can you tell us the story of that and how it developed?
Doby was a Northern New Jersey fellow product, and the Eagles signed him. He played a little bit before he went. I went in the Navy during the war. He was a student at Long Island University, and as many the case of black players, and I have white ones too, I'm sure, he didn't want to lose his athletic ability, eligibility in college. So he played for them under an assumed name. I believe he called himself Larry Walker. we played a few games for them, and then he went into the Navy, and he came back out. Of course, he's still, and now he's Larry Doby. You know, he's not going back to college. He's going to play ball. And he was a star, a second baseman for them at the time, although he wound up being an outfielder with the Indians. And he was one of the keystones of their winning the Negro National League pennant and a Negro World Series in 1946. But now, you know, Jackie Robinson had been signed before the 46 season. Don Newcomb, who had been a Newark Eagle, and Roy Campanella, the catcher, all signed by the Dodgers, and the barrier, the color barrier, is starting to break down. So Abe comes into the Eagles' office one day, middle of the season. I mean, they're off 47 season, are off to a great start. Dobie's smashing the ball everywhere. Abe comes in and says, you're going to get a call from Bill Beck. I'm going to make clear, Abe and Effa had a very good division of labor. Abe hated administration, and she was very good at it. So when he says, you're going to get a call from Bill Beck, that means we're going to negotiate. So you do the negotiation. So he called, and he says, I want to buy Larry Doby's contract. Well, they're in the middle of, you know, the post-championship season. They're doing well, but the handwriting is on the wall. And so she agrees. And Beck says, I'll offer you $10,000, which wasn't, I mean, it was a lot of money for a Negro League team. It wasn't a lot of money for Larry Doby, as we know how he turned out. Of course, he hadn't got there yet. So she says, $10,000, that's really not much. You know, if he were white, she's a good negotiator, and she's very, this is true throughout her life, she's very outspoken. So he says, you know, Mr. Beck, if he were white, you'd offer me $100,000. And Mike says, well, I can't. She says, well, how about this? If you keep him on the roster for the rest of the season, you pay me an extra $5,000. Now, Beck did not have the situation that Ricky had, where he had a Montreal farm team, where Quebec, where, you know, integration was pretty well accepted. He didn't really have a place to stash Toby anyway, so he kept him on the roster for the rest of the season, which he was probably going to do anyway. So the Eagles got $15,000. They, as far as I know, they were only the second team to actually get paid for the services of one of their players crossing over into white baseball. And that's the most, maybe the most anybody ever got. She drove a good bargain, and she drove a bargain with a guy who was pretty honest about all this. He recognized the value of black players. You know, he's the guy who then signed Satchel Paige to become a major leaguer, and other players. So Luke Easter after that. So she drove a good bargain with a guy who would listen, and that's how Doby became a major leaguer.
We're speaking with Jim Overmeyer here on Sports Jam. One more question about Effa Manley before we move on to another one of your wonderful books. But when it comes to her making the Hall of Fame in 2006, and you played a role in making sure that many of the Negro League players made it to the Hall of Fame and part of various committees through the years, do you think she would have had success in the major leagues as an administrator or an owner?
Had her colleagues, or her potential colleagues, contemporaries, been able to overlook the fact that she was a woman, she'd have been very successful. Could they have done that? I don't know. There's a racial aspect here, and there's a gender aspect. She fought, she had to carry on a lot of warfare in the Negro League owners' meetings behind closed doors to get what she wanted. Her husband was very supportive, by the way.
I was going to ask, the relationship between them is pretty unique, isn't it?
It's very interesting. They weren't at all alike. Abe made his money in the numbers gambling business, which we now know as the state lottery, and I'm certainly in your state and mine and every other one I can think of. But then it was illegal, but, you know, there'd be raids every so often. But Abe was a banker, which is to say, ran a numbers game in Camden, New Jersey, and made a lot of money. We don't know how much, but obviously he made money. He's from a farm family in North Carolina, and that's you know, sort of he's a self-made man in a sense. She's a very light skin, and then that was important. I mean, there was a pecking order within the African American communities, and the light-skinned people were, unless they could prove otherwise, were thought to be somewhat more culturally refined, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's strange to talk about now, but it was true then. I mean, black sociologists wrote about it. So she's she's very good at book work. She's very good at negotiation. She's any organization that she belonged to, baseball or otherwise, eventually she became the secretary of the treasurer. She became the de facto treasurer of the Negro National League. They kept electing Abe, who had no more business being treasurer than I do being a rocket science, but they wanted him out as an officer. And of course, everybody knew that Effa was doing all the work. So they were very different backgrounds, and they very different what they were interested in. She liked society. She liked, she had a lot of friends who were entertainers, and his players said, what he really liked to do best was to ride the bus to the games and play cards and drink beer in the tavern with the ball players. So, but they saw what needed to be done. They saw that improvements that should be made in the Negro Leagues, and they had one vote between them in these league meetings, and they always went in solid and stayed solid. And Abe, if you got angry at Effa, then you would also have to deal with Abe. And they're very, very not alike. But when they got together on the business of baseball, they were very, very alike.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is Jim Overmeyer, baseball history author who specializes in the Negro Leagues. He's out with two new books this year, Queen of the Negro Leagues, Effa Manley and the Newark Eagles, updated in April, and Composia, the Homestead Grays, a biography of the Negro Leagues owner and Hall of Famer that came out in January of this year. He's also the author of Black Ball and the Boardwalk, a history of the Black Atlantic City Bacharach Giants team of the 1920s. Cumberland Posey is an amazing figure because he was so talented in two sports and, in fact, is in the Hall of Fame for both baseball and basketball. Obviously, he's another person that we don't necessarily know a lot about, that people, you know, because he lived back in his career began in 1911. So it's not like the people of today and the ballplayers of today even know about Cumberland Posey, do they?
No, they probably not. They know a lot about the Grays. The Grays are recognized as, one of the extremely good classic teams of the Negro Leagues. But yeah, attention to the owner is probably a little lacking, but that's true of most sports teams. I mean, who do you want to talk about? You want to talk about the players, you want to talk about the owner, but you can't have a team without the owner. So he's important.
And he was a heck of an athlete.
He was a good baseball player. He hit his ceiling in the early 20s. He was about a little over 30 years old. He's playing for the Grays. I mean, he's running the team. He's managing the team. He's playing left field for the team. He wasn't bad. He was a good fielder. He was very fast, which had a lot to do with his basketball success. But he get it on base, but he really wasn't that great a hitter. As he started to make the Grays from a regional Pittsburgh attraction into a team that was, you could take on the road and be recognized and make a lot of money playing all over Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio, he started to replace the hometown stars with better players. And one of the people he replaced was himself. And, you know, there are a lot of people who would have hung in until the bitter end, but he knew what he had to do. He was an outstanding basketball player. He was
maybe the best player in that area, right?
He was felt to be one of the best, if not the best, in his prime, black basketball players in the Eastern Seaboard, or in the Northeast.
He's got an amazing connection to Penn State, Pitt, and Duquesne, all part of their makeup.
Yes, he went to He graduated. His parents were well off by any standards, well off. His father had risen from a steamboat deckhand on the Ohio to captaining ships, to building his own ships, to becoming a partner in coal mining businesses. And they were very well off. His mother was one of the leading intellectual educational leaders in Pittsburgh, in the Black Pittsburgh community. So they sent their kids to college, and he went to Penn State, where he's the, where he's recognized as the first African-American varsity athlete there. And if he had been a little less of an athlete and a little more of a student, he might even have a degree. But he left in the middle of his sophomore year, as college students sometimes do. He came home, he enrolled in at Pitt for a little while, and he dropped out again, and later said that he did it because of extreme discrimination by the basketball coach and the athletic director. And so he didn't want anything more to do with that. So now he's running the Grays and playing on this top level basketball. It's actually, his teams are starting to move out of just Pittsburgh area recognition. They're playing in New York City, they're playing in Philadelphia. And around 1923, Duquesne comes up with this new starter in their lineup, whose name for the box scores is Charles Cumbert, and it's Posey. And I talked, and he's now recognized as the first African-American athlete at Duquesne. If you talk to the registrar there, they say, he may have been the first athlete there, but he never went to class here. This is not unusual in those days. if you read Rob Ruck's bio of Art Rooney, Rooney was not apparently not a ringer, but Rooney knew a lot of guys who were, and Rob talked to them. This whole idea of, the NCAA was in its infancy, communication among teams. I'm sure everybody in Pittsburgh knew that Charles Cumbert was Cumberland Posey, who was playing elsewhere. When he wasn't playing games for Duquesne, he was playing for his Loendi team and scoring a lot of points in either place. But he played 3 years of varsity basketball and a couple of years of baseball on top of that. Played 3 years of varsity basketball, one of the leading players on the Duquesne team. And at the appropriate time, he graduated, quote unquote, and went away.
After writing this biography of Cumposey, if you, in another lifetime, ran into him, what would be the one question that you would want to ask him?
Well, a lot of them, I expect. I guess I'd like to know. I'd like to know what his confidence level was at different times, because he took that team. He started playing for the Grays, in the early middle of the 1910s. And they were just a local team, and then he took over the team, and pretty soon they're playing all over Pittsburgh, white teams, black teams, whoever. Then they're getting on streetcars or into touring cars and going a little farther and a little farther. And then they're, by the 20s, early 20s, they're a highly, very recognized, successful regional team. And then by the late 20s, they're playing, they're still independent, not in a league, but they're playing Negro League teams and traveling around. And then by the early 30s, they're in a league. He had this incredible long view of success. And he only really had one in the middle of the Depression. They almost went out of business, but then so did a lot of other, they weren't unique. And then they bounced back, and then they won 9 straight Negro National League pennants from the 30s up through the middle of World War II. I mean, yeah, I'd love to know if he had any doubts. He never seemed to have any doubts. He was in the papers a lot. This helped because, he was an educated guy. He's a good writer. He wasn't fancy, but he was a good, solid writer. He wrote a sports column
for the Pittsburgh Courier, right? Yeah.
And he's never wrong about anything. I think the only guy he ever met in his life that he agreed with was the guy he saw in the mirror every morning when he shaved. He just was an incredibly self-possessed and strong-willed individual, even more than Ethel Manley. That's saying a lot. And I'd love to know if he had any dark hours where he said, God, this is never going to work. How am I ever going to make this work? Because he made it work in the end.
Pittsburgh Pirates every now and then will wear their Homestead Grays uniforms. Does that help people to be aware and maybe they'll check out Jim Overmeyer's book?
Well, I hope so. I wrote a nice full-page piece on him for the Post-Gazette a few months ago. That hopefully will help. What's happening, or at least what we hope is happening, is this 2020 is the centennial year of the founding of the first Negro League in the Midwest. And Major League Baseball, I mean, there's been this continual celebration over the years. There have been Negro League days where teams will wear the uniforms of the black teams that played in their cities, and players have been, of course, there are very few left to be honored, but players have been honored, or their families have been honored, you know, on the field. And it's come, now we're in the centennial year, and Major League Baseball has let it be known in an unofficial way through a sports writer, a national sports writer. They are contemplating recognizing the Negro Leagues as a major league. Now, why, you might ask, does Major League Baseball get to be the gatekeeper here? Well, I'm not sure. It's a historical thing, but they are. And they recognize white leagues, one of which only lasted a year in the 1880s, as major leagues. And they're getting there. I think they're going to do something. I would hate, you know, there are a lot of ways to approach this. I think in the next year or so, there'll be some significant recognition. Will that make all of us famous? No. Will it make us feel really good about all the years we put in pushing this stone uphill? Yeah, I think it will.
Jim, I know that there are people that are watching and listening to this edition of Sports Jam that certainly remember Rupert Stadium on Wilson Avenue. 18,000 fans may be packing into that stadium at one time now during the Negro Leagues, or remember the back rack Giants in Atlantic City and players like Henry Pop Lloyd being a part of some of those teams. And I found it fascinating because I think you have the same passion for this that I do, because you and your wife Ellen really enjoyed Boardwalk Empire, the HBO series.
Yes.
And you watched it together. I love that. I wish it was still going on, to be honest with you. And the first two seasons were fascinating, weren't they?
They were. The first season was pretty factual. The second season was pretty factual. And then, of course, like most TV series, it went out into outer space. But I'm researching the book while the first series is on, and we're watching it every Sunday night. And something will happen, and I'll say, you know, that really happened. And something else will happen, I say, you know, that sort of really happened. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. All of those people, most of the people that were there that they portrayed were actually there. Maybe they weren't exactly doing what they were doing in the series, but I wish they had the real Nucky Johnson was a bit of a baseball fan, and there was evidence that he would, among other things, because, you know, the black boat was important, and they ran a sort of a mini Tammany Hall type thing where everybody got taken care of if you voted for us. And he was known to go drop in at Negro League games, and I really wish they had like this little bitty, even a minute where he goes and observes the game and says, "Oh, who's that really good player over there? Oh, his name is John Henry Lloyd." You know, that would have made my day, but they didn't do that.
That would have been nice. And you know, you've written a lot about Harry Bacharach, Atlantic City politician, and the Bacharach Giants were named after him. Just a few words about Harry Bacharach.
Harry was a fascinating guy, you know, and a lot of the Atlantic City, a lot of the book is really about when it isn't about baseball, what in the world was going on in Atlantic City? There's no place like Atlantic City. A whole city built for entertainment, basically. Has no significant industries, has no significant natural resources or anything like that. Built in a glorified sandbar in the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. Bacharach was a very successful politician there. And generally, to be a very successful politician meant sooner or later, you were probably going to get indicted, like Lucky Johnson, maybe put in jail. But Harry managed to avoid that. He did get indicted for vote fraud one year, but so did almost everybody else. When Woodrow Wilson ran for governor, he won, except in Atlantic County, which was primarily Republican. And it turned out there were more votes for Wilson's opponent than there were registered voters in Atlantic County, which kind of set off an investigation. But then the Atlantic County Pauls investigated the other side. There were two simultaneous grand juries running. Everybody got indicted. Almost all the cases were thrown out. Harry was great. He could lie down with those dogs and hardly get up with any fleas on them. And the Bacharachs, he had a couple of political operatives in the Black community in 1916 when he was running for mayor. He said, we're going to put together this amateur team at that time. We're going to call them the Bacharachs, and you're going to have 9 moving billboards out there twice, 2 or 3 days a week in the late afternoon. And he always had an interest in the team, but he never really ran it, and he kind of drifted away from it, but the name never changed. They were always the Bacharach Giants, and that was the reason.
So let's have a little fun with the people that you know the most and have written about. A new player by the name of Josh Gibson IV breaks through, and everybody wants to get him on their team. Effa Manley and Abe, her husband, Harry Bacharach, and Cumberland Posey are all fighting to get this player on the team. Who gets him?
Well, Posey gets him because he's a Pittsburgh guy, and Posey had the inside track. Effa would love to have had him. In fact, one game at Rupert Stadium, this is her story. Gibson hit a late inning home run to beat.
And you're talking about the real Josh Gibson now.
Oh, the real Josh. Yeah, well.
Because I was just giving a fictional new guy, but giving him the same name. But continue on with your story, because you're talking about the real Josh Gibson.
Well, I said she would have loved to have had him. He hits the home run. They're all filing out of the park. And she says, Mr. Gibson, you broke our hearts. And he said, ma'am, I'm paid to break hearts. So, yeah, she'd have loved to have him. Posey would have gotten him. Posey had this incredible – Abe was a good scout, talent scout. Posey was an incredible scout. There are like a dozen Hall of Famers who played for the Grays at one time or another. He could go get them. The Grays always paid well, except for that little glitch there around 1932. They paid better than other teams. They paid on time. If Posey wanted Gibson, even the fictional Gibson, he would have had him. I mean, he wouldn't have played for anybody else.
You spent time in the Army as a captain.
I did, a long time ago.
How did that change your life?
Brought me to New England, which is kind of odd because I'm here in Arizona. But I grew up in Indiana, lived in Indiana, got out of college in Indiana, went in the Army. It was 1968, that's what you did. And I got stationed at Fort Devens, a sort of low-key little place outside of Boston. And the Army left me there for 3 years. I have objections to going to Red Sox games, going to Harvard Square, having a very good time, you know, when I wasn't doing my Army stuff. So decided I wanted to stay in the East, started looking for a job as a newspaper reporter at the time. One of the Boston dailies was going under, and everybody knew it, and all their people were jumping overboard and taking all the good jobs in Eastern Mass. So I kept filing resumes and working my way west. And then just before I hit the New York border, I got hired by the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield, Mass. And stayed there in one thing or another. Also, when I worked for went into government, and I worked for the Massachusetts legislature, then the New York legislature, then the New York budget office, and then the New York court system.
Your background is interesting. It's not your typical baseball historian author background, is it?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of baseball writers who don't write full time, particularly in the Negro Leagues. You don't write full time unless you can live on a very, very, very slim diet and budget. When I started the Manly Book, there was a guy named John Holway, who's one of the famous writer historians about the Negro League. He interviewed everybody back when they were all still alive and loved to talk, and he wrote a lot of books. And so I wrote him a letter. I had about 20 questions, as I used to say. And most of them were about, you know, where can I find this resource or that resource? And he answered. One of the questions was, should I get myself an agent? And he answered all my questions. He wrote back, he answered all the questions. And the answer to that was, you will make so little money writing about Negro League baseball, you will not want to share it. Mm. And I need to write about that too. Mm. It's a niche thing, but it's breaking out. You know, as I say, Major League Baseball is finally, you've got this 100th year celebration. Major League Baseball is interested, really interested in the Black Leagues now. You've got the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, which is doing a great job of educating people. I mean, they had to close down, you know, during the worst of the virus, but they built this really, really, well, they had it anyway, but they expanded this really good online program series. So they made the most of a bad situation, and now they're open again, and they have the online series. So there's a lot happening in black baseball history and Black baseball writing.
We see that your video there, you have Matthew Warren Overmeyer, which that's your son, right?
Yes, he seems to be the last one to log on to Zoom here. He's a student at the University of Arizona, which of course is almost entirely online now. So.
And what's his favorite book that you've written so far?
Well, I guess the Manly Book. It's dedicated to him and my nephew, Peter Wyden, who lives in Madison, Wisconsin, who's also African. He's African-American. He's an executive with the University of Wisconsin football program now. He's a football guy, but that's all right. So I guess, well, Matthew and Ellen have had Effa Manley drilled into their heads for 30 years now. He's barely 30 years old, so I guess his whole lifetime. I guess that would be it.
With that in mind, last question for you here on Sports Jam. You and your wife, Ellen, get two magical tickets sent to you that you're able to go in the Wayback Machine and you can see one Negro League baseball game. What would it be and why?
Last game of the 1946 Negro World Series in Newark, where the Eagles won their only Negro World Championship, beating the Kansas City Pages and Buck O'Neill's Kansas City Monarchs in six games. And boy, I'd have loved to have been there.
I think a lot of us would have loved to have been there. Jim Overmeyer, you are keeping us, and not only keeping us informed, but you're keeping the Negro Leagues alive with your wonderful books. And we wish you the best of success, and I'm sure there are more to come. And we look forward to, do you have a new project that you're working on that you want to mention?
I don't at the moment. When I finish your book, it's like I never want to write another book because they're a lot of work, you know.
Oh, I bet.
I finished the book and at the end of the last year, and then I got contacted about the update for the Manly Book, so that was a little more work too. So we're always involved. I mean, we're a tight little group, not as little as we used to be. We're still a tight group. Negro Leagues researchers, we're always helping each other out. It's like, hey, do you know anything about this? Yeah, I do, you know, or vice versa. I'll ask them, you know, anything about this. So we're always working on something, but it isn't always something that's, you know, big. It's you still have to, I mean, there was so much of the history lost when people stopped being interested in the Black Leagues. Fortunately, and I did some of these interviews, a lot of the major people were interviewed and there's stuff on tape and all of that. But there was so much statistical stuff lost. There are still people working very hard to capture every box score of a Negro League game as they can and put it in a database so we have decent stats. And it's just the Negro Leagues were underfunded. They were, you know, they were on the wrong side of the segregation thing in a lot of ways, including financially. And they were covered mostly by the Black weekly papers, which might or might not run a good box score. And it's just, it's odd, you know, you're working to revive the day-to-day history of something that happened 70 years ago. It's, you stop and think about it, I said, that's pretty weird, but we're doing it, you know? So I'm doing a little of this, a little of that. I do not have another book in the works at this time. But, you know, like the Posey book, I sat around after Backracks and I said, well, I don't know what I want to do yet. And I was asked to peer review a manuscript of a book on J.L. Wilkinson, who was the owner of the Kansas City Monarchs, who were really, Wilkinson was like the Middle Western equivalent of Posey, and the Monarchs were like the Middle Western equivalent of the Grays at that period of time in the 30s and 40s. So I do it, and it's a good book, and it's got my interest up. I say, you know, there's going to be a book on Wilkinson. There ought to be a book on Posey. So zoom, away we went.
And I think that you would be quite fascinated, too, with an edition of Sports Jam that featured the wonderful Monty Irvin, who played for the Newark Eagles.
Oh, my.
Him and Jimmy Heath, the wonderful saxophonist, talked about the Jim Crow era, and it was a fascinating conversation about how both of them were fighting for the honor of Sarah Vaughan at one time at a club, and I believe Ernie Banks was there too with them. So you may want to check that out, Jim.
I will.
Congratulations on all the work you've done to give recognition to these ballplayers who, and owners who so richly deserve it. People like Effa Manley and Cumberland Posey and Harry Bacharach, people like that who really deserve to have their place in history. I want to give one more shout out before we end this, is that a great listener of this program and the radio station is Michael Shannon, who Michael Shannon was one of the stars of Boardwalk Empire. Uh-huh. And he was fabulous in that show.
He was.
Say hello to him. And people can go back and see more of Boardwalk Empire. It's, you know, it's available out there. You can catch it. Jim Overmyer, what a wonderful time reminiscing and finding out more about your books. Thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
A pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the podcasts by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam to find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes and on the NPR list of podcasts. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll hopefully see you at the game.